what I thought I'd do for this talk is to give a perspective on the UK innovation system as seen from the SME, the growing SME in a disruptive area, technological area. And the reason I thought this might be of interest and appropriate is because that's where you get your growth, that's where you get your jobs. That's a very important area, and I think it's very relevant to this strategy going forward for UK PLC. And while this is all my own views, I have checked it with quite a number of people on the business side in particular, but also on the academic side, so it's not just Andy's random thoughts. And I hope they provoke some discussion and some thoughts about how we might move forward. I'll say a few words about the broader context for that situation, worldwide context. I'll say something about the university-industry interface, some examples. I'll make some innovation policy suggestions, which I hope have some merit, and then I'll conclude. So let me just say a few things about the context. First of all, in universities, in my view, the enterprise culture within universities is fantastic, and there's a substantive change compared to 30 years ago when I started doing this sort of thing. So I think that's great. It doesn't need to be improved. It's as good as I see anywhere around the world. And then more generally talking about universities, I certainly think of them as having three functions. Of course, teaching, and people tend to forget that we teach. It's important. But as far as the facing the industry bit, I tend to think of it in two ways. A service-based offering, where you support current industries, you do as much as you can for them. And then another offering, a third way of thinking about this, teaching, serving, and then disrupting. So this is where you're trying to generate new industries, create new industries, because disruption is either happening, is available, or you can achieve it. And I'm going to concentrate on that disruptive thing. To put it crudely, if you ask a company what you should do or what their problems are, and they tell you, you do something different because they've already identified it and you want to disrupt. Or at least you bear that in mind. Global competition. So we're pleased that the CSR has maintained the research budget in cash terms, but actually our competitors have increased higher education R&D compared to us. So we just have to remember that, as was shown on Adrian's graph. Also, another interesting thing is that the UK appears to have a higher share of R&D by subsidiaries of foreign companies compared to other territories. And according to a study which I read by Hughes and Mina, a report on the UK R&D landscape from Cambridge, there's a very interesting suggestion based on study that the UK has the lowest share of government support for independent SMEs. So if you take out these small companies which are subsidiaries of foreign multinationals and you just concentrate on support for that group, it's only 3.5% according to that study. And that's a worry. That doesn't sound right. So our global competition situation is odd in one or two ways. If I look at the industry sector, well, it's changing, and it's changing in two kinds of ways. One is technological change, of course, in particular my own area, invasion of digital into everything, although there's technological change in other sectors like materials, which cause disruption. But furthermore, what appear to be stable industries are also being disrupted because of the business structure, the size of companies, fragmentation, consolidation, and so on. So Kodak out of business, you'd think that that was a very steady thing. And as importantly, another point, there's been a loss of corporate research labs, and these have not been replaced by anything. I personally think this is a huge problem and a huge gap. IPR is complex, very complex, and it's oversold. It appears to have a greater importance in people's minds than at least my and my colleagues' experiences. It's got to be there. You've got to do something about it, but it's not, you know, business is about selling something to somebody, and that's how you make a profit, not negotiating IPR. And also in the IPR scene, broadly speaking, there's too much money being made out of the IPR industry itself. So your patent attorney, the people who pay your sub every year for maintaining a patent, it all adds up to being very expensive. Just try paying a patent off for its lifetime as an SME directly. You'll find it's almost impossible. Capital, moving on with my sort of troll here. First of all, it's an expensive product, so if you can avoid it, buying it, then bootstrap your business without it. But it's interesting to note about the comparison of VC industry and angel funding. So the VC industry in the US over the last decade has just returned capital, no more than that. And in Europe, it's been a capital sink. So rather than producing wealth, it's been sinking wealth. There are some views on why that is. Whereas angels, in particularly in the UK, angel funding has done rather well. Now, the amounts of money involved are smaller, £1 million, £2 million, even going onto what I might call a super angel fund, say £10 million. But that's been doing very well. They've been making money and recycling it back. The system's been working. And the public markets, well, they're variable. I took a company public, UBSense, earlier this year on AIM, and that was an interesting journey. It's not straightforward. It's a specialist sport, one might say. Fiscal policy, well, these schemes like R&D tax credits, smart, they're fantastic, right? So from an SME point of view, bring it on, and in the report it says you'll be bringing more of it on, and that's marvelous. The smart awards came back, fantastic. So that's all jolly good. But I would say that the whole thing is very complex from an SME point of view. It keeps changing, and stability above all is crucial. And occasionally there are some oddities. So just let me illustrate with an oddity. Capital gains tax for under enterprise relief, entrepreneurship relief, is reduced to 10% from its 28%, but only if you hold 5% of the company or more. So if you're being diluted down towards 5%, rather than making a business decision for your business, you worry about being diluted below 5% because you're going to pay 28% tax. And I see all over the place people jinking and diving in unnecessary ways because of that particular point. Very odd. Finally, culture, and by that I mean sort of broad universities culture. Well, we've become very institutional in universities, and I'm not sure that's all good. They're like multinationals rather than sort of more entrepreneurial things. And the government system, the ministries appear to be very conservative and constrained. You kind of have to, at all levels, it appears you have to show the outcome to of what you're proposing before you can actually get going. That's too bad. Okay, let's move on to the university industry interface. Collaboration, innovation in practice, and then I'll just pick a couple of examples. So collaboration. I think of it in two ways. High barrier, high cost is one. Low barrier, low cost is the other. High barrier, high cost is where universities is encouraged to produce patents. It then sells those patents either to companies or startups for as much as possible, and it prices research high with full economic costing. All the rest of it is high. One might call that the turnstile model, which tends to lead to lower volumes. There's almost nothing in it for an SME of the kind I described, but it's in place. That system is really what we're doing. Another one would be to essentially go back to low barrier, low cost, where you emphasize generating know-how. In that situation, you might still do patents, but you would give them away, or you'd assert that there are no patents. The university makes sure that nobody gets a patent. It's a pre-patent stage, and you price research low. One might call that the revolving door model. And by jingo, there is a lot of stuff for SMEs in that sort of situation. So I think we're running the high barrier, high cost, and I would encourage towards the low barrier, low cost, if possible, go for volume. Innovation in practice. Here is the way many companies in this SME high growth disruptive sector actually seem to work. First of all, it's business that's generated by business. There's a startup or maybe an entrepreneurial bit of a large company, and they come up with the business ideas. their liaison with universities, recruitment. They want the very best people. In order to have that recruitment, they work with a group to generate that know-how. They have a good interface. And then in order to generate that know-how and to know what's happening in the academic sector, they want that group, that research group, to be as brilliant as possible. And then they use it as a kind of, I think of it as a radar mechanism onto the worldwide academic world to tell them about any disruption that might affect their business, which they're doing. So let's have a look at, so that's how I see innovation in practice. So let me just pick a couple of these. Arm, 30 billion, 35 billion chips have been made by them. It's been 30 years. How did that come about? I mean, the original Arm technology, and I was involved in that, so I can speak with complete authority on this. The know-how was in the university about designing chips and CAD. This was in about 1981, 82. We were doing that stuff in the university. That was the know-how. The radar screen, which walked out and people employed, the radar screen that was going was onto the idea of reduced instruction set architectures being done in California. What brought to the attention. The IPR was none, and the business model in Arm's case was that ultimately it became a corporate spin-out from Acorn and so on. So I suggest that it's very much on the very low cost and innovation in practice model. Let me pick another one, RealVNC as a company. What is this? It's a much smaller company. This is a software company whose product enables you to control a desktop from another machine, move desktops around any to any. The interesting thing is that there are about 250 million licenses that have been taken for this particular piece of software. So it's everywhere. It's huge. And it's rather profitable. The know-how was about graphics and networks. The radar screen was actually rather interesting. It was a business method. It was about open source and how you might do it. And it had a very adaptive business plan. So again, a situation where you might want the business plan before you start wouldn't have suited that particular case because it kept on changing like they always do. So given that set of illustrations of how innovation works actually in many, 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 many of these companies, let me make a few policy suggestions. I don't know if that's you, Adrian, over there, that I may manage to pick, but anyway, maybe it is. So let's have a look at institutional structures, and I'm thinking of the academic thing. So I think contracting a variety of models, Hefke contracting a variety of models, and this sounds like it might be within the recommendations that Tim's making, for different university sectors to balance their teaching side with their service side and this disruptive side, I think is the way to go. That diversity is very important. And then allocate on that basis. I think it's very important to encourage hybrid institutions. By hybrid institutions, I mean institutions which, in effect, lie between industry and academia, maybe sometimes more on this side, maybe sometimes on that side. An illustration might be ESIT in Queen's University Belfast, which is a research center in the university which can and does employ development engineers who can do part of the next stage. And then with this point about corporate research labs, I think this is a great hole, and I'm so sorry, but Catapult, both the name puzzles me greatly, and the way it's being done puzzles me greatly. The opportunity is there still to do what Herman Hauser suggested, which is industry-led or completely based labs which do as good work as any university but in a more applied way, as the modern version of the old industrial labs. Funding of research. I think the twin system is good, so, you know, balancing the Hefke and QR with the research councils, but I think it is quite appropriate. I'm not completely, you know, wedded to the Haldane principle. I think it is quite appropriate to make suggestions of broad goals and that sort of thing. But I worry about the research councils right now because they seem to have fallen into neither fish or fowl situation. They're neither choosing quality on the one hand as the dominant thing, nor really having specific bets, directions on the other side. And I think this is a bad place to be. It's the worst of both worlds. So what I would suggest on research councils is bad quality, essentially in whatever area, because you can't really predict what's going to happen in the next 5 or 10 years. Bad track record, so that's different, you know, and the track record is likely to be quite wise. So that's on that's the fish. And then the fowl is get some experts in domains and give them money and give them a managed program and let them make decisions and get on with it. And that's your bet. And that's the other side of it, right? But not this ground in the middle. Accountability and measurement. Well, there I would suggest is we measure less. And in particular, I'm addressing myself to Son of Ref. And measure all kinds of output and try and measure risk-taking. So I say, my view is that the most important thing in innovation from a university walks out on its own 2 feet rather than other measures, and so trying to encompass that. And be very careful with this measurement, because bad measurement can airbrush out, if you like, some of these good things, and then it all can become self-fulfilling. So if you only say count companies as spin-outs if the university has a shareholding in it, then that's going to distort. That's not necessarily a valid measure. University IPR and tech transfer. I think this needs to be looked at very hard and in some kind of independent way, because, again, there's sort of a kind of a self-fulfilling direction happening here, and I think independence is necessary. In the California University of California system, there is no technology transfer office. There is no emphasis on all that sort of stuff. In fact, there's almost complete separation, and in that situation, they are very successful. So, evidence. What I would do, or think through doing, is to take the technology transfer office, split them up into two halves. The mentoring bit, the support bit, stays in the university. The other bit, the bit that negotiates and contracts, is privatized and goes out of the university system, become private entities. Furthermore, they don't have a monopoly situation with any university. They can compete, and they get a shareholding on value added, essentially, rather than on a monopoly. It's kind of a right of some kind, or I don't know. And I think that would be a much more appropriate, healthy system, which might grow to be stable and better than the current one. With IPR, furthermore, it's like these vouchers. I would suggest that when a university gives some IPR away, it should get a spending voucher. It should get a credit for it. So not only do they not get paid for it directly, there is a bonus they get. Finally, a couple of things that relate to SMEs and capital at the bottom. So this 3.5%, I think, is a real problem that I mentioned earlier. So I would encourage further tax benefits for UK independent SMEs. In Holland, there is a very competitive scheme, which, again, is quite broadly drawn, which delays paying tax on dividends. There is a fiscal incentive. And just to give you a slightly more wacky suggestion, compared to 20 years ago, the university's plural infrastructure, the oscilloscopes and all that, is not used as much by small companies as it might be. So maybe every Friday afternoon you could just open it all up. Say, okay, on a Friday afternoon, a small company can go into the university, use this stuff for free, furthermore, even get a bonus from Hefke for so doing, right? Get a green shield stamp, to use that phrase. Because at the moment, there is an awful lot of infrastructure, and it's not always used, and it's being paid for by the taxpayer. Finally, on capital, recognize the success of angel funding. For capitalism, money has to be made, and there's going to be a flow of money-making wealth, and that part is working. So I would encourage investment in these funds, in super angel funds. The Royal Society Enterprise Fund is an example of that sort of fund. And it might be that actually the VCs come along, and that's some sign of that, and join in on these super angel funds and some of the practices that make one successful and the other less successful may actually infect. So my last slide to finish off in conclusion, stability and simplicity are crucial. I would incentivize the revolving door model rather than the turnstile model. I'd be very much more cautious about measurement. I'd measure less and measure much more wisely. I would be very careful of innovation myths. The Whitehall bubble seems to have ideas which may not be completely joined up with the real world. And finally, if you forgive me, just one flag waving as head of department. May I wave a flag for the department? Forgive me. But we have this board at the front door, and on it it's got just under 200 companies which were spawned by the department, okay? We call it the Hall of Fame, and we keep in touch with them. I'm, you know, familiar with many, many of them. And that's the heart of, you know, the Cambridge phenomenon. That's it. And they almost all are on the model I've just described. So here is your evidence base. Go and talk to them. Some are multi-billion dollar companies in there. Some are dead as a dodo. But, you know, there it is. There's your evidence. Thank you very much.